We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
We are a little over the halfway mark in April, and spring has yet to officially spring, for lack of better terms. But that's not what this interview is about. I'm glad I got your attention. April is also Autism Acceptance Month, and according to current statistics, an estimated 7 million U.S. adults currently have autism and don't know it, which at one point included my next guest, Dr. Thomas Pineo, the medical director of UPMC Community Osteopathic. And today we welcome Dr. Pineo on The Spark to discuss his later in life diagnosis, working in medicine while on the spectrum, and his advocacy work. And I'm happy to have Dr. Pineo on The Spark with us today. Hello, Dr. Pineo. How you doing?
Hello, Marky. It's really nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it is. It is my pleasure. So this is something that I did not know was a thing. Being diagnosed later in life, I was under the mistake that everyone pretty much knew if they were on the spectrum or not by the age of six. I don't know where I got that age from, but that's what I thought. So tell me how wrong I was.
So I think we're probably a victim of our own success in that regard. Somewhere around 2009, the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with recommendations for people who care for young people, children like family practitioners and pediatricians, to institutionalize autism screening. And as a result, we have really seen growth of the autism diagnosis in young people. But there are many people like myself out there who missed out on that screening. So people from my generation and just a little before and a little after. So you think of Gen X for sure, baby boomers, and much of Gen Y. And it's also important to know in 2013, the diagnostic criteria changed from where they were when I was a kid back in the 80s. So for example, intellectual function is no longer part of the diagnostic criteria, and where intellectual function exists across a spectrum, you know, high IQ, low IQ, middle IQ, it's all good. And it really just talking about a series of diagnostic traits or life experiences that that drive the diagnosis of autism.
So what does somebody do that felt as though that, you know what, I may have been on the spectrum, I may be on the spectrum, but never got tested. And they're in their 40s, they're in their 50s. What would you tell somebody to do right now that's possibly listening at home?
Well, so the value of getting a diagnosis is profound. And we know from research that mental health and physical health realities for autistic people are quite a bit worse than they are for non-autistic people. We know that life expectancy, for example, is reduced by 16 years for autistic people as compared to their non-autistic partners. And so just getting a diagnosis in and of itself can make a person less depressed, can reduce the risk of suicidal behavior or self-injurious behavior, can improve overall sense of well-being, and bring clarity and joy to a person's life where they once felt that they knew they were different, but they didn't know exactly how or why. And so it's probably not only important to get a diagnosis, it may be actually essential for an autistic person to see and understand the root of why they feel the way they feel.
Now, what does a later in life diagnosis look like? Is it you as an adult going to the doctor's office? Is it getting a referral? What does it look like?
So in the world of autism, I think of it as like layers of an onion. Mm-hmm. In the middle of that onion is the PhD psychologist that does formal autism evaluations that take maybe 3 or 4 hours in an afternoon. Mm-hmm. They're usually preceded by, you know, getting an appointment, which may take months, and, you know, a bit of research and really digging into your childhood and talking to your parents. And it's very thorough and can be quite expensive and may mm-hmm. or may not be covered by insurance. The next level out would be your mental health provider. So you think of social workers or counselors. The next level out would be your primary care physician mm-hmm. or, say, the healthcare system as a whole. And the last layer out are people you know. Mm-hmm. So it could be a spouse, it could be your children, it could be your parents, it could be a friend, it could be a colleague, it could be a future employer. And part of the reason I think it's really important for me to come on your show and talk about my own experiences is because not only is it valuable for people to have a diagnosis, mm-hmm. it's valuable for people to know that there are other people mm-hmm. that have a diagnosis.
Yeah.
And so when you talk about mental health benefits, just getting a diagnosis is great. Mm-hmm. And knowing that there's a partner in this mm-hmm. and knowing that other people are out there
right.
saying, hey, this is happening to me too. I would love to share my journey with you mm-hmm. and to know that you are not alone.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing that I was going to say. It's good to know that you're not alone and you have somebody that you can lean on. You have a community that you can lean on. So what are the potential implications of later in life diagnoses?
Yeah. So there's a ton. You know, as a early 50-year-old guy getting a formal autism diagnosis, I had the privilege of being able to look back over my life through the lens of autism mm. and to look at some of the, you know, some of my many special interests that that I've enjoyed over the years. There's so many things that I, you know, went deep on, you know, playing my trumpet, mm-hmm. you know, in different bands, playing the guitar in different bands. I developed a very deep interest in windsurfing at one time in my life. Mm-hmm. You know it's a special interest when you're pursuing it to the detriment of the people around you. You know it's a special interest when they call you to dinner mm-hmm. and you say, I'll be there in about 2 hours because I just have to keep typing right now. Mm. You know, so that, you know, that is really one of the autistic traits that I think of as really being a gift, but can certainly also be a burden at times. And it just creates that what we call a spiky profile, the spiky profile of autism spectrum disorder.
And for yourself, let's talk about your story here. What was it? Was there any moment? Was it a series of moments that made you want to get tested?
So my experience is very similar to other late in life autistic adults. And in that, I came to my diagnosis through my children.
Oh.
And so my oldest child had been diagnosed incorrectly, which is extremely common, by the way, mm-hmm. With obsessive compulsive disorder. And that's actually one of the most common disorders that women, autistic women, will receive prior to getting the right diagnosis of autism later on. Mm-hmm. And she had been working with her counselor for just about 6 years. Of course, she was a very smart young lady, and she had been doing her own research, and it was becoming apparent that she should have been, you know, getting better mm-hmm. and faster than she was. And at some point, she said to her counselor, she said, you know, hey, are you sure that I have OCD? This doesn't really feel right. And thankfully, the counselor said back to her, I wonder if we're dealing with autism here. Mm. And that day was the inflection point for our family because my daughter dug deep into the world of autism, and she started seeing things that were more subtle, more nuanced. And she was 100% correct. It was shortly after that that our second child was diagnosed. And at that point, the two of them were armed with an abundance of information, and they turned their sights on me. Mm-hmm. And over the dinner table one night, they said, "Dad, have you considered autism?" And I really resisted it because, frankly, I did not fit the stereotypes that I was carrying with me in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And those stereotypes that were handed to me from my youth and from my formative years were that of a person with high support needs,
mm-hmm.
Lots of externalized physical behaviors that although I have some of those, they're not not as extreme as some.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was and am an autistic adult who, I guess you could say, flew under the radar for so long that, you know, my definition of normal just became me.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that was really important for me is that as I look up and down my family tree, and I think this is so true of most people diagnosed with autism, is once that one person gets diagnosed, they start seeing autism in other family members.
Mm.
And it's clear to me that autistic traits have been normal for me in my family for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And so as much as a person might look to the world and say, "I'm different," when I looked to my family, I fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I was experiencing was really normal,
yeah.
even though it may not have been, quote, normal to the rest of the world.
Mm. Now, what were some of your initial challenges after receiving this information? Because I'm assuming you just were like, "Oh, okay, cool," and then went on your day. What were some of the challenges? Because you're also in medicine as well.
So I got to be honest, I don't really feel like I experienced a lot of personal challenges.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I just had this overwhelming sense of clarity mm. and release and just understanding. And that understanding of myself and as a doctor, to be able to take that understanding and put it out into the world mm. in my patient care has been just so rewarding and so profound. I think it's important for your listeners to understand this, that autism exists in 2.78% of the population.
Oh, wow.
That's 1 in 36 people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's now. That may change in time. The incidence of type 1 diabetes, right, diabetes where you need to have insulin in order to live, is 0.5%.
Oh, wow.
The incidence of type 2 diabetes, which is far more common,
mm-hmm.
is 5.5%.
Mm.
So we think of diabetes as being something that we all are aware of. We don't have any problem talking about it.
Right.
Autism is 5 times more prevalent than type 1 diabetes and only about half as prevalent as type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are sitting there listening, and let's say you're a healthcare provider and you're thinking to yourself, "Oh, what's this guy talking about? I don't have any autistic people in my practice." I'm challenging you right now to start partnering with your patients to find mm. them and help those people discover that thing about them that is unique and honestly gives them very high risk for health outcomes and emotional outcomes.
Mm.
And it may drive differences in the way that we deliver information or communicate with one another, the way that you may adjust the lighting in your room,
mm-hmm.
the way they experience anxiety. It's so helpful. So I would just share with you a couple of experiences that I've had in the hospital
mm-hmm.
where I have a patient who's struggling, and it may be with insomnia or anxiety. And when we talk about sensory input, and they share with me that, in fact, the sensory environment is hard on them,
mm-hmm.
all they know is that they're experiencing anxiety. They don't know the source of that anxiety.
Mm.
And so I say to them, "Well, hey, let's try turning down the lights," or, "Hey, let's try putting on some noise-canceling headphones or earplugs or something." And it is so gratifying to me the following day when I come back and they're sitting there at their bedside chair dozing
mm-hmm.
with their headphones on, right? And they're like, "This is the best sleep I've had in years."
Wow.
And if you can imagine living your entire life, 50 years, 70 years, however many years,
mm-hmm.
and you've been experiencing anxiety, never knew the source, imagine an $11, $10, $12 pair of headphones
mm.
making a transformative difference in the way that you experience the world.
Right.
So there's really simple things that we can do. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit in autism. And, you know, as much as we've been talking about autism for 100 years, in some ways I feel like we're still just getting started.
Mm. Dr. Pinnell, my next question here is, what are some of the common misconceptions about autism in adulthood?
Well, one of the most damaging stereotypes that has been out there about autistic people for years is that we don't have feelings.
Yeah, I heard that.
Or that we don't have emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to speak a little bit about this concept of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
There's empathy that we use. There's what we call cognitive empathy, where I am discerning your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the empathy that I feel, the kind of emotion that I experience, called affective empathy, when I discern your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Autistic people may have trouble discerning emotions, but once they figure those emotions out, those emotions can have very deep impact. And I think, you know, when we see the images on television and we see the different characters and all the different television shows, it's very common for those individuals to be portrayed as if they're somewhat robotic.
Mm.
And really nothing could be further from the truth. I know a number of physicians, autistic physicians, who have reflected on this topic over and over again, and they talk about just how deeply they care about their patients, really to the point of it hurting them. It's not at all uncommon for autistic people to be engaged in advocacy work.
Mm-hmm.
Autistic folks have a very deep longing for social issues and for the people that comprise those social movements. So it's not at all uncommon to look out there in the media or on television to see autistic people leading social movements and really taking charge of an issue that is affecting them deeply or affecting us deeply.
And I'm glad you brought that up because I'm going to definitely talk about your advocacy work along with UPMC's with autism. But first, for the person that is sitting at home that may be thinking like, okay, I may or may not, or my aunt or my uncle may or may not, what are some signs folks should be looking out for?
So what we're talking about is the diagnostic criteria of autism, and autism is really broken up into two broad categories that are social and behavioral. And social has to do with the way we interact with the world, so how we communicate. An example of this, right now we're having a conversation.
Indeed.
But my contribution to this conversation is far greater than your contribution, right?
Absolutely.
So this is kind of a lecture style, a lecture format.
Mm-hmm.
And where, let's say, a non-autistic conversation is more like a ping pong match where the ball goes back and forth and spends about the same time on both sides of the net.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that autistic conversation may feel a bit more like a lecture. And the thing that is so much fun about that communication style is, and I can tell you, when my oldest daughter was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, she became an expert in sharks. And so if you ever wanted to learn about sharks, all you had to do was ask.
Mm.
And you had to sit down and strap in and get ready for all the data. And, you know, that's the beautiful thing about the autistic brain, is that it just takes these special interests and then just loves to talk about them.
Mm.
So that's one. There's a bunch of other traits,
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes struggling with nonverbal cues, maybe having a more focused social group. And then, of course, we mentioned the restrictive, repetitive behaviors and interests, so that tendency to go deep and narrow topics, rather than necessarily engaging in all topics in a roundabout way,
mm-hmm.
Really becoming experts in narrow fields, and I think the last area is sensory.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of your central nervous system as being the clearinghouse for everything coming in and everything going out. Having a slightly different sensory system means that there are fabrics or things that you come in contact with or flavors or tastes or sounds that will be experienced more profoundly or differently than a non-autistic person. In the healthcare setting, that is so important because the way we experience our own internal organs can be different than a non-autistic patient. Mm. So, for example, when do you have to go to the bathroom? When do you feel full? What does it feel like to have a heart attack? Mm. How do you feel when you have a broken bone? All of these things can be a little bit different for an autistic person than a non-autistic person.
Oh, that's interesting. That is definitely interesting. So before we head on out, we have about a minute here left. What are some of your advocacy work that you have been doing in the realm of autism?
This has been such an incredible journey. I feel like there's so much thirst and so much yearning for folks out there to hear this message about, you know, autism in adulthood, right? Autism's not just for kids anymore. Mm. Not to mention the fact that there are 50,000 kids every year aging out of childhood and becoming adults. So this is such an important topic for us to get and to get well. As a healthcare system, I've spent the last couple of years working on educational programs. We have access to this thing called a sensory kit. The foundation supported the purchase of 150, I forget exactly how many, sensory kits. And in those kits, we have hearing protectors and sunglasses and some fidget toys and a weighted blanket and other items to help a person, an autistic person or a person that's having sensory issues in the healthcare setting, to help ease them through their healthcare experience. Mm. So we distributed that out to all of our emergency rooms, all of the nursing floors, and all of our hospitals in the South Central PA market. And they've been sent out to our urgent cares. And the reports that we've been getting back have been so positive. Yes. We're really helping people, and that's great. I could go on, and I really appreciate the time to get together and to talk about something that I'm so passionate about.
Yes, yes. I say this a lot, but every time I say it, I mean it. I could sit here and talk with you for hours on this. I want to thank you for coming on the Spark and really giving us the game on autism and bringing more awareness to this. Dr. Pineo, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.